The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week I meet rising British director Rupert Wyatt, who went from Jailbreaks to Great Apes. We discuss his thrilling direction on the blockbuster Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And Oscar winner James Marsh is also on the tail of a special chimp. Project NIMH uncovers the story of a very strange, very 70s sociological experiment. I speak to James Marsh about what it means to be human. Also on the show, legendary Chicago documentary maker Steve James, director of Hoop Dreams, discusses his latest doc, The Interrupters, about a revolutionary solution to that city's inner-city tensions. Could the same happen here now, too? Helping me review some of this week's other releases, Zan Brooks will be joining me. We'll be looking at Audrey Tautou in Beautiful Lies and Dominic Cooper in The Devil's Double. Yes, it's a Simian Cinema special. It's Film Weekly.
The applications go beyond the disease. There are indications that show that therapy can improve cognitive functioning, memory quality.
What are you saying?
My father didn't just recover. He improved.
You mean increased intelligence?
It's not conclusive, but yes.
I want you to start testing the revised 112 on chimps ASAP.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes has already taken the top spot at the US box office on its opening weekend, and it looks certain to repeat the feat here. But underneath the skin of this Hollywood spectacular is a very British affair, with Andy Serkis, the acting pulse to the digitised central ape character Caesar, and a breakthrough role for the stage actor David Oyelowo. Meanwhile, directorial duties are taken on by the relative newcomer, director Rupert Wyatt, whose debut feature, the prison break drama The Escapist, while little seen, clearly impressed many in Hollywood with its superb cast, pacing and tension. All of that has been brought to bear on Wyatt's take on The Planet of the Apes, so I was delighted to meet up with Rupert, especially when he confessed to me that he was a huge fan of this show, I might add, and I had the effrontery then to put it to him that for the lead ape, Caesar, the central character in this film, this is also a kind of prison movie.
This had elements of that. It's a great, you know, he's a chimpanzee, this character, this protagonist of ours, but he's Che Guevara, and he comes out of nowhere. He comes out as this, grows up as a young innocent and lives in this domestic household and sees the world for what it could be in all of its glory, all of the things that we as a civilization and as a species aspire to be, but also he then sees the dark side.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing arc for a character and for me as a filmmaker to tell that story.
And presumably if you love the cinema of the 70s, we'll go late 60s as well, you like the original Planet of the Apes scenario as well. I mean, your film actually pays quite a nice homage. Occasionally we hear a quote from, you know, the damn dirty ape quote, and then there's a bit of Charlton Heston on the television play somewhere.
Yes, there is. I was always keen. I mean, the writers had a lot of what they call Easter eggs in the scripts, and many of them work great. And
so, what are Easter eggs, technically? Go on, I don't know that one.
Oh, it's an American term, I guess. It's just the discovery, you know, Easter egg hunt. You find little things hidden here and there. But I think I think as long as it works for the story, as long as it serves our story and it doesn't take you out of the film, so more often than not, those slightly ironic nods to the franchise can be really toe-curling.
Yeah.
So where possible, I was always looking to make it serve the story. There's a moment in our film where Caesar, our chimpanzee, our lead, is in his attic where he's grown up and he's working on a little model, and that model happens to be the Statue of Liberty, and that works great for the mythology, but it also plays into the fact that he's a prisoner in this attic and what does liberty represent, and you know, so it was trying to serve many different.
Yeah, and it totally worked. I got all of those things from that one little image, so it worked. What I also liked about it was that if you never see Planet of the Apes, and I was a fan of the TV series, which always was on before the big match on a Sunday afternoon,
yes,
and you could watch that, and that was, so it was brilliant. So you could watch real apes, and then you could watch football apes because they all had beards in the 70s. You remember, of course. But I loved that show, and if you don't even know that, I think your film sort of really isn't connected to those films at all in a way. I don't know if it's planned to be a franchise, if it was a success, which it clearly is now.
Yeah, I mean, I think what drew me to it in the first place was the idea that it's set in the real world. Mm. The great thing about the original film and then the subsequent sequels is that it's about us. It's a mirror held up to us as who we are, but it uses apes to tell that story, which is great because it gives you such freedom and so many liberties to explore certain themes and issues that perhaps you couldn't do with human characters because it would be too on the nose. And I think the fact that what we've done with this film is so different from the other films in the mythology, which is we've set it in the modern day. Mm. We set it in our world, the world that we all can connect to. Mm. It's not sci-fi for that reason. Science fact, I suppose. But so I think, yeah, that was the main appeal for me, and I think that's what sets us apart.
Absolutely. Talk about the technical aspect of the film and the blockbusterness of it in a minute technically, but just from your point of view, going to be in charge of such a big project, you know, summer blockbuster, you know, you're up against your Marvels, you're up against superheroes, you've got to make a splash as well, otherwise, because it's a pretty, you know, Darwinistic kind of world out there at the box office, as much as your film is about evolution as well. You know, if you're not a success, it's a big pressure. You look like you sort of, you know, like it hasn't bothered you at all.
Oh, no, inside it has. I think it's quite nice being the underdog in many ways. It's sort of ironic because that's what our story's about, but the expectations for this film were mixed, to be perfectly honest. There were people's preconceptions going into this film that, oh God, another Planet of the Apes, and why do they want to do that? And
that's I had one of those
preconceptions. Fair enough, yeah, cynical cash in, and I think there's something kind of wonderful about therefore being off the radar. People's expectations for this summer did not include this film, mm. and so to be able to just get on and make the film and make it as good as we possibly could, you know, tell the best story possible, because I think so often with blockbusters, people tend to forget the story sometimes, and it's not the priority. And fortunately, with this, we were able to focus on the story and the storytelling, and we were given that freedom, which is rare, yeah. I think.
What you've got, which a lot of blockbusters don't have, is a really good structure of acts. You've got the beginning, and then you've got the bit at the home, and then you've got the freedom, then you've got episodic bits where he goes into the prison movie and then it becomes a disaster movie, the kind of big So I mean, you've got actually kind of compelling kind of different parts to it, which I think really help pull it along and make it that fun sort of entertainment that a summer blockbuster needs to do. But of course it's got brains.
Well, great. Yeah, no, it's three acts. It's broken into those exact three acts, and that was quite a challenge actually, because early on in the edit we looked at it and we thought, oh, we've got three different films here. How are we going to make that work? It's testament to the editors, Conrad Buff, my editor who cut Titanic. I mean, he knows his way around a big ship. So, but he, you know, the pacing, all of that, and you're constantly, I guess, trying to find the subtle moments in a story. So often with these big films, everything's splashed onto the, you know, broad strokes. And the great thing about this was that at its heart, we had a very, very nuanced performance from Andy Serkis. And that's what binds the film together. He's our protagonist, and always from the get-go I wanted to tell the story from the point of view of the apes, you know, make us empathize with them and feel compassion for them.
So was it always Andy Serkis? I know he does this, we know, you know, he's the go-to guy for kind of stuff in a chimp suit, which is terrible because he's a brilliant, brilliant actor and a great, great friend of the show as well. I don't know if you heard his Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll interview.
Yes, I did, yeah, exactly.
Did you know you were working with him then? When did he come on board and how much work did you do with him? Because I know he did, Weta, who obviously he'd worked with before on The Lord of the Rings, did a lot of the work. Were you backwards and forwards to New Zealand? Were they sending stuff?
Well, we did. I mean, he came on as soon as we made the decision to go with performance capture, because we had the option of using live apes. That was our other way of making this film. We couldn't use actors in prosthetic suits because we're talking about real apes, and the other films don't. They're humanoid apes, so anatomically we could never make that work. And so live apes was an option, but we didn't want to go down that road because I think ethically it would have been completely inappropriate to tell the story of this film and exploit apes to do so.
And you get that PG Tips thing going as well. It's too 70s.
Yeah, there are a lot of PG Tips lines between Andy and me on set.
Right, and only the Brits know this.
Yeah. If you want it, son, I'll play it. But I think performance capture was always an option, but it was never a sure thing because we didn't know if we could pull it off. Because everyone, I think Fox sat on this script for about 3-4 years because they thought, we can't make this film. And because the technology is not there, and it's because of Avatar, basically. It's always the way with this technology, or any kind of technology. It all evolves. Oops, sorry. It all evolves.
Technology right there.
There you go, yeah. Let me turn it off. it all basically evolves through practice and how Avatar, you know, Jim Cameron invented the face capture camera, and it was his idea, and what that has done is just taken a huge leap forward in terms of what you can then gather information wise through detail of facial expressions and things like that. So I think the moment we thought, okay, we have a chance of using this technology, and Weta, their great relationship with Fox because of Avatar and other films, they said, look, we think we can do this. No one knew because we didn't have another film to reference. King Kong 2005, 25-foot gorilla. I mean, they called it the Dark Ages for them in terms of their technology. And I think this film shows that you can now create, they're like Dr. Frankenstein, you can now basically create something with a soul that is flesh and blood on screen that you really believe in.
And did Andy notice the difference between sort of when he did Gollum and King Kong to how it is now?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, he gets bigger billing now. I mean, it's like Andy Serkis, because he's the... And everyone's not going, where's Andy Serkis? This time they're going, oh, he's that.
Yeah, someone the other day called him the first digital superstar. I'm not sure, but it's true. And what's wonderful is I think for performance capture, when you're talking about actors that perform roles where it's not them physically on the screen, it's another embodiment of them, but it's their performance. First and foremost, you need an actor with no ego, because, you know, it's not about them. It's about their performance. And if you think about, I don't know, if you think about John Hurt playing the Elephant Man, John Merrick, and him buried beneath those layers of makeup, and he won an Oscar for that. But it didn't look like him. And his performance shined through all of those layers. And it's not that dissimilar with performance capture. You know, Andy is playing every single moment of Caesar, and you see it.
And were you there directing him for that bit? You did that. Where did you do that?
On set.
In LA?
In Vancouver. Okay. We shot the film in Vancouver and San Francisco. But yes, I mean, now it's got to that stage where, and this is the first film to have really done this exclusively, where we took the technology on the road. We took it outside into sunlight and on location. And so what you have is you have your actors playing the apes, in our case, acting alongside James Franco or Frida Pinto, who are playing the humans, and they are there. They're there with us, and
out in the forest,
in the house, on the street, all over the place. Yeah,
they're everywhere. You kind of failed to get your notice that on the back of the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Project NIMH is out this week, documentary by James Marsh. I don't know if you saw. I spoke to him last week. He hadn't seen your film yet.
You haven't seen it, so I guess.
But I mean, there are bits of NIMH, and that are especially the sort of first act of your film that are sort of, you know, particularly, you know, referencing NIMH. Had your writers read that? Have you read that? Did you read the book of Elizabeth Head?
I know the writers knew of the story. I'm pretty sure they did, because I could see definite echoes. There's a radio show, I don't know if you know, in the States called This American Life every week on NPR, and it's a great show where they do different stories every week about American life, and one week they did the story of NIMH. And it was during our prep, actually, that I listened to it. We used, in particular, a whole other story as our main reference, Andy and me, which was Oliver, who was a human Z. And they thought he was the missing link. He was around in the 70s, so same sort of period. And he was an ape, a chimp, that they found in the jungles of the Congo, and they brought to America, and he became like this performing chimp. And he didn't have any hip joints, so he could walk upright like a human, and he preferred to do that. And you look into his eyes, and he looked incredibly human. And he was a very tragic sort of character, because he then became sort of part of the Japanese chat show circuit.
Right. So you've got the freak show, the almost Victorian freak show kind of element going on, plus that 70s nature versus nurture experimentation, which is all in your film. It's all in NIMH too. I mean, NIMH, who actually scrapes his knuckles, doesn't walk upright. He has an array of outfits like yours, you know, not of course smart dungarees, sort of stuff that I wore in the 70s, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, we tried to make it as plausible as possible with that respect, because I was worried with clothing that it would end up looking like Every Which Way But Loose. But we thought, okay, well, Will, James's character, James Franco's character, he's going to have old clothes cast off, and those are the sort of clothes that Caesar would wear. Yeah. So they're old, like, Berkeley College t-shirts that he's got on, and things like that. But the great thing about the clothing as well is when Caesar starts to take that decision to be with his own kind, he starts to shed human, you know, clothing and what that represented.
Yeah. I talked to James Marsh about this element of Caliban as well, that you teach me language, my profit on it is that I can curse. Well, you know, it's the promise that I can riot in this. And actually, as I'm talking to you, riots on the streets of London and everything, it's very sort of eerie.
Yes, do you think that?
It's Murdoch going, ah.
He's marketing the film. Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Amazing. But yeah, I think it's a great way to tell a story about our times, to do it using another species.
Yeah. You know? Well, it works brilliantly. I mean, it's both great fun and then sort of eerie and clever and all at the same time. So I was very impressed. You are now Rupert Wyatt, not only a guest on Film Weekly, your favourite film podcast. You're also number one at the box office in America, which is a huge... I mean, I know British people are kind of like, oh, it doesn't really matter, Marvel, so I should be in the theatre. But it's America. It's a massive deal to be number one. I mean, you're hot as potatoes, you know, and you're here. I know you're going on holiday next week. Shouldn't you be in LA, kind of, you know, snorting cocaine off the breasts of prostitutes and making deals?
I think that would be short-lived. Keel over. too tired. What I'm so happy about is the fact that after two years of hard work with everybody, that we've actually got something that people like, and that's not always the case. Yeah. And the fact that I now have the opportunity to do things that I really want to do is great. But I'm going to take a holiday. Yes. Yeah.
Well, enjoy it. You're King of the Swingers, basically, with The Rise of Planet Apes. Absolutely brilliant blockbuster. Really enjoyed it. You're even kind of... I love Super 8, and I didn't think this would be better. This is Super Ape.
Super Ape. I like
See
it.
What I've done.
I think they were calling it Apatar.
So. Super Ape. Super is better.
Ape. Yes, that is better. Yeah.
Rupert, brilliant to have you on the show. Lovely to see you.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you.
And Rise of the Planet of the Apes is on UK-wide release from Thursday, the 11th of August. Now, we have a competition for you to win a beautiful T-shirt from Rise of the Planet Apes, plus a one-sheet teaser poster signed by Andy Serkis and the director, Rupert Wyatt. It's a really, really good prize, this. And to win this, all you've got to do is tell me, Andy Serkis is not the first Londoner to have embodied an ape in the Planet of the Apes series. Which famous other British actor was one of the apes? I don't mean Helena Bonham Carter in the first one, or Tim Roth. I mean in the original Planet of the Apes. Who was the famous London-born actor who played... Oh, I'm going to tell you, he was Cornelius. Just go to our Facebook page, Film Weekly Fans, that's us, and let us know who on there, and you can win a T-shirt. Now, we do have women and men's sizes, because they're very kind, Fox. They provided us with a really cool T-shirts with a kind of Banksy-esque kind of graffito on there, and the one sheet is really cool. So one prize only. Let us know who was that London-born actor, and you can win it. Very exciting. Now, from one dominant primate to another, Zan Brooks joins me to review some of this week's other releases. The opposable critics we are today.
We are,
Zan.
Aren't we? We'll look cackling at, and hooting.
We'll look at Rise of the Planet of the Apes. We'll also look at Project Nim as well. Then we'll talk about Audrey Tautou in Beautiful Lies. And we'll also talk about Dominic Cooper in The Devil's Double. Twice. Two Dominic Coopers for the price of one, I tell you. Zan, but we've just heard from Rupert Wyatt there. For me, you know, very nice chap. Great surprise that he's kind of pulled off a blockbuster.
It's good, isn't it?
It is good, isn't
and
it?
And he seems sort of wonderfully at ease with himself about
yeah.
it.
I mean, it's kind of silly in that blockbuster way, in the way that blockbusters should be.
Yes, I think that this is a, you know, the hopes weren't high for
Not
this,
at all.
I don't think. Particularly after the Tim Burton reboot of like 10 years ago, which was a total disaster, I thought.
Yeah, it was boring.
It was boring. This is a lot of fun. And there's kind of weird nuances in there, which is surprising for a film about, you know, an ape that takes over the world, I guess, yeah. without giving too much away.
Does it give anything? Do you need to have seen... What I liked about it almost refreshingly was that if you've never seen any of the Planet Apes, you didn't have anything to do
it's
with
absolutely
it.
Fine. There's a few little sly references to the original 1968 film and some of the events spilling out of that, but it doesn't matter. Go and see it. It's good. I was surprised by it.
Yeah, I was thumping my chest along with the best of them.
Very interesting double bill as well this week with the other ape movie.
Yeah, now, you and I, as film critics, will have seen Rise of the Planet Apes and Project Nim almost sort of back to back.
Yeah.
I saw them as a double bill
have
in a way.
Have they blurred in your brain?
Yeah, they have, totally. But I suppose normal people won't probably see them as a double bill. Can they survive in the marketplace together?
Yeah, I think that they're obviously going for very different audiences here. I'm trying to work out a kind of thing of like, you know, you've got the kind of King Gorillas who's going to go and see Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then you've got the sensitive orangutans of the art house scene who will go and see Project Nim. Yes, the Gibbon. and Project Nim is obviously a documentary. One of the films has a happy ending and the other doesn't. We probably shouldn't say which is
which. Well, it's up to you to decide, I suppose.
Both feature meddling scientists who get a little out of their depth. And both are very good. I mean, you know, coming into this week's podcast, I would have, my prejudice would have been to say you've got the kind of the trashy Hollywood blockbuster and then the classy art house documentary. But both are very good films and they're standout films for the week.
Absolutely. Thank you, Zan. Now let's talk about Audrey Tautou.
Yeah, let's do that.
Not an ape at all.
No, she's more of a pixie, I think.
I think so, absolutely. She rose to fame playing Amelie, in Beautiful Lies, she plays Emily, who's a neurotic hairdresser in the south of France, who's fixing up her mum to go out with the Arab handyman played by Sami Bougila, who actually likes her. It's a French farrago.
Ils ont envoyé.
J'ai reçu une lettre d'amour, inspirée, émouvante.
C'est formidable. Ça fait un ange qui t'a écrit cette lettre.
Ça fait 5 jours que j'attends le facteur.
T'attends une autre lettre?
Audrey Tautou, does she do it for you? Is she one of those winsome French girls?
No, she isn't. I'm normally a sucker for the winsome French girl, but she's a little bit too winsome and a little bit too kind of pixie prepubescent for my taste.
She's back with the director Pierre Salvadori here, and they had a sort of hit with Priceless, which was a heartbreaker on the south of France coast in a Nice in the casinos of Monte Carlo and all of that. And that film, even though it shouldn't have worked, sort of managed it somehow.
I didn't see Priceless. She's forever emblazoned into my memory for Amelie, which I hated with a deep and poisonous passion.
I wanted to poke my eyes and then her eyes.
And then torch the cinema.
I was a bit like that with Beautiful Lies, I've got to say. It drove me bonkers. I hated it.
It's a very annoying film. The cute levels are sort of around the eyeballs, and the blood sugar is very high, and there's lots of sort of Gallic shrugging and double takes, and everybody's very saucer-eyed. It's incredibly schematic. You know, she's playing this beautician. There's a slight potential here in that she's genuinely a dislikable character.
Yeah.
There's a sort of slight riff on Jane Austen's Emma in that she's sort of meddling and matchmaking, and it's a bit of control freakery about it. And she's completely vile to the Arab handyman, who's actually a former translator, very overeducated, has had a breakdown and is in reduced circumstances. And she's completely vile to him because he threatens her with his intellect. And he, of course, adores her for reasons that I have no idea.
No, I mean, why does he like her?
Yeah, and continues to like her even though she keeps kind of firing him and belittling him and then trying to set him up with her mother, played by Natalie Bay, who's a great actor, and here is reduced to either mooching around like a wet weekend or skipping madly around the marina in bare feet because she's so excited to be in love.
It's like bipolar on the screen.
Yeah, she is, isn't she?
I'm worried about Natalie Bay.
Yeah, it's a sort of awful sitcom that's everybody's overacting wildly and kind of almost looking to the camera, and you kind of keep expecting a cymbal crash and canned laughter to come in. It's annoying.
That's the brutal truth about Beautiful Lies. Zan, we're going to talk now about Dominic Cooper, an actor of whose talents I've never been quite convinced until now. Here he is in The Devil's Double. We had him on the show last week. He plays Uday Saddam Hussein and the man hired to be his double, Latif Yahya.
You will have whatever you want. Everything I own will belong to you.
Uday, I am my father's son. I would give my last drop of blood for Iraq. But when this war is over, I'm going to work in his business. I am the eldest son. I have brothers and sisters. I have given them my word.
Sleep on it.
Uday, you are asking me to extinguish myself.
Yeah, the nice boy out of Mamma Mia and the History Boys. Here he
is. Yeah, and the Duchess. He's generally an uninteresting actor. He's kind of a sort of suave, smoothie chops bit of decoration in films, isn't he?
I think so.
Maybe that's not his fault. Maybe that's just how casting works in British cinema. And this, if nothing else, is a stretch for him and a leap. And by and large, he does it well. He's playing Uday Hussein, the very famous son of Saddam, who was tragically shot dead a few years ago after a career of rape and pillage and cocaine addiction. And he's also playing Latif Yahya, who was Uday's old classmate, who is coerced under threat of death and his family's death into becoming Uday's body double. So he has the plastic surgery and he becomes spends 5 years as basically a decoy because there are various people within Iraq, surprisingly enough, who want to kill Uday Hussein.
presumably the father of many of the 14-year-old schoolgirls who he goes around snatching off the streets. I mean, it's really quite a sort of fall of the empire kind of look behind that curtain of the Hussein dynasty and how that excess is kind of corrupting from within.
It is.
At least that is sort of what I think the film's supposed to be.
Well, I don't know if it is. I mean, perhaps it's one of those films. I think Lee Tamahori is a talented director, but he's crass as hell.
Yeah.
And he makes no bones about it. And I think that he is half in love with the sort of the Scarface style aesthetic of this film, with the bling and the marble and the gold and the women jumping out of swimming pools and things like that. And occasionally is playing Uday Hussein as a sort of buffoon, this sort of comic character. But this is also a comic character who rapes and murders and, you know, as you say, you know, is basically a pederast and is going around the schools. I felt a bit squeamish at times about this.
I mean, in a sense, what is that also not perhaps what Latif was feeling? Because there's a point where Latif is obviously seduced by the bling and the women. In fact, particularly one played by Ludovine Sagnier, understandably.
Of course, she was
in Beautiful Lies, that might have been better. There's that sort of kind of he's seduced by that as well as repelled by it. The moral kind of equivalence you can't really approach.
That's fine for him to be, but you expect the director to have slightly more command
of
the material.
I think perhaps it swamped him in a way, and he couldn't find a way to
dance
through.
Yeah.
And it becomes a sort of slightly a strange adventure movie when he's running away with Ludovine Sagnier, and you're like, well, do I want you to get away? Do I really even care?
Yeah. There's also, you know, there's a slight problem with it. About my squeamishness in that maybe it's just a little too soon afterwards, where there are kind of the victims of this regime are still, you know, the ones who weren't killed are still there mourning their families. And it just felt a little bit previous to be making this film now.
Even though it's set
now.
In the first Gulf
it's
War.
It's set during the Iran War, isn't it, as well? It's set in the sort
before
of early
the early
1980s.
80s.
You know, it's very energetic, and Dominic Cooper gives a great performance, and it's certainly watchable. And maybe if it had come like 10 years afterwards, 10 years from now, I might have appreciated it better without the sort of reservations that I had.
Okay, that's The Devil's Double. Zan, we've also got on the show this week The Interrupters. We're going to talk to Steve James about that, the director of it. Have you seen that?
I have seen it. And, you know, by God, we've been waiting a while for another Steve James film, haven't we?
Yeah.
He did Hoop Dreams, you know, 16 years ago now, which was great. And I think this is probably a great testament to the, you know, to what they call slow journalism, isn't it? Where you spend a bit of time on a project and you let it kind of percolate and develop, and you get something weighty and serious. And that's certainly this, as well as being incredibly timely for the current week.
That's The Interrupters, more of which we'll hear about very shortly. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed for all of Zan's musings on the world of cinema. Go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. Director James Marsh took a well-deserved Oscar 2 years ago with his superb documentary Man on Wire. This week, Marsh is back with another compelling tale. Project NIMH tells of a zoological and sociological experiment carried out in New York in the 1970s, where a baby chimp, NIMH, was taken from her real mother and raised as a human child in a brownstone in the Upper East Side. To delve further into this fascinating story, I spoke to director James Marsh.
There was no family discussion about should we, shouldn't we? You know, it was just, oh, we're having a chimp. We're going to teach a sign language. And then the reality of it is sort of hitting you that it's really, you know, it's alive. It's not a doll. It's not a toy. It's not a human. It's a chimp.
And not for the first time on Film Weekly, I'm joined by James Marsh. He was here last time for Man on Wire, and he's here again for the equally stupendous Project NIMH. Congratulations, James, and welcome back to Film Weekly.
Indeed, we actually spoke about Red Riding too, I believe.
We spoke about Red Riding because there was some joy that you were back on home turf, in period still, nevertheless. But now you're back in New York in the 70s.
Indeed, I've gone back there. Yes, it's definitely a 70s film set largely in New York, certainly the beginning part of the story. As you know, it's a story of a chimpanzee that's taken from its mother when it's born, and given to a human mother to bring up as if it were a human child. And the idea is to try and teach that chimpanzee to be like a human being and thus to learn language and thus to tell us what he's thinking about. All fascinating ideas. Of course, it doesn't work out that way, but that's the going in sort of premise to the story.
Where does, people will remember you rightly and gladly from Man on Wire, such an extraordinary story of almost fable of New York in the 70s. And this too was, you know, the chimp was known as Nim Chimpsky because Noam Chomsky, the great semiotician, was famous at the time. This too was a great New York story. Is that what you were attracted to? Yet more kind of almost urban myths that kind of seem to populate your work.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, you know, it's a very archetypal story. You know, there's elements of Frankenstein in it, I guess, too. And there are all kinds of other sort of narrative comparisons you can make. But for me, it's really a biopic. First and foremost, it's the life story of a chimpanzee told on film, which I don't think I've quite seen before. Animal's life, you know, I mean, there's Black Beauty, which is the novel, and there's the great Bresson's Ozard Balthazar, which, yeah, is the film I watched before I embarked on the project.
And there's Born Free as well.
There's Born Free, lest we forget, which is, I guess, that's a feature, right? It's sort of based on fact.
Yeah, I mean, the late John Barry with that.
This is the first chimpanzee biopic on film. And clearly it does emerge from a time and a place, and that time is the 70s, and there are things going on in the 70s, you know, with the sexual values of the time, people's ability to smoke pot when they want to, that kind of stuff, which definitely feeds into our story. And of course the location is academic, up Upper West Side, New York. Yeah. It starts off there, but then Nim goes on this big journey around the whole country. He doesn't stay in New York. He goes on this sort of picaresque kind of journey through human institutions, and many different kind of people end up interacting with, like the Bresson film, where you learn more about the humans you do about the donkey.
Yeah, and there was a recent film, Nenette, which Nicolas Philibert did about an orangutans. There is another apes film out at the moment as well, The Rise of the Planet Apes. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I've not seen it yet. No, people have often tell me about it, and I haven't seen it yet. But, you know, I think there's a kind of cunning plan on behalf of our distribution company to release it on the same day.
Yeah. Brave plan, I think.
I think brave. I think I'm all for it. Okay. I think that we can be in the slipstream of this big Hollywood movie. Mm.
Directed by a Brit as well.
I didn't know that.
Rupert Wyatt, yeah, first, almost second time director. I've seen it. It does a really, really fantastic job. And I saw it before I saw your film, Stranger. And I have to say that your film kind of adds, having seen it, it adds to theirs enormously.
Oh, that's good to hear. I mean, hopefully that idea will get out into the world.
I mean, there's a bit of their film that is almost Nim. They take him home, they dress him in dungarees, and kind of they take him out, and then gets too big, and they put him into an ape sanctuary where there's cattle prods and everything.
We have all that in ours too, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And theirs becomes like a prison movie, actually, which is where Rupert Wyatt's first film was, The Escapist.
Well, that all makes sense. So, well, good for him. And I'm very curious to see it, actually. Because I've been told there are these parallels between the two films. Probably their writers were aware of some of these animal experiments that were done in the 60s and 70s.
Well, obviously you were aware of the original Planet of the Apes themselves. Yeah, exactly. Was that something? And of course they were 68, 71, 72, 74. Yeah, were they going on at the time?
There was definitely, you know, the sort of popular culture of that time. It feels like that's part of it too. These experiments started on chimpanzees in the 60s, these social experiments to home rear them and to teach them language and teach, toilet train them, all this sort of stuff that was going on, investigate their sort of sexual habits and all this sort of stuff. So clearly, and Planet of the Apes obviously comes out of a similar kind of culture. And there's a kind of recognition, perhaps over-recognition, that they're more like us than they actually are. Mm. And these experiments that were done, you know, Project Nim is a good example, that show us that they're actually less like us than we think they are, but more like us in surprising ways. They're hedonists, the way that we are, it would seem. That's not something we talk about very much. Oh, you know, they're so friendly and warm and mischievous. Well, actually, no, they like to smoke dope, and they like to drink beer, and they like to kind of go on bicycle, fast motorbikes and stuff like that. They're real thrall seekers, chimpanzees.
They're hairy bikers, par excellence.
They certainly are. And also they're very physically very sort of robust, and that's, I guess, Planet of the Apes is about that too, that they're very powerful animals.
Did you, just in terms of making it again, we talked on Man and Wire, the reconstructive elements of that heist movie, which was kind of thrilling to do. Here you're reconstructing some of it, I presume. You had a host of archive footage and wonderful pictures to kind of work with as well, which I suppose is the starting point. You wouldn't do it if you didn't have it. But how much of this did you work on? Did you use real animals?
We used a man in a chimp suit, and what I tried to do was not to dramatise things in a very front-on way, but to actually come at it that you see the aftermath of something happening or something about to happen. So you're getting a kind of echo of it, if you like, and you're trying to, in a sense, visualize the echo as opposed to a literal-minded rendering of chimp behavior, which we couldn't do and wouldn't want to do. But we couldn't use a real chimpanzee. I knew too much about chimpanzees at that point. I wouldn't last 5 minutes with an adult chimpanzee, nor would you, for that matter.
The second of a pair of monkey movies, Project Nim, is out on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 12th of August. Now, also out this week, as you heard earlier, is The Interrupters by Steve James, the director of Hoop Dreams, which was so brilliant in 1995. In his new film, he follows a year in the life of a group of community leaders on the streets of Chicago as they mediate between warring gangs.
What was a violent night in Chicago? 9 people were shot in just 5 hours. 1 person died.
124 people have been killed so far this year, 1 per day. About the number of Americans killed during the same period in Iraq.
And I'm delighted to welcome Steve James into the Film Weekly studio. Welcome, Steve. Welcome to Britain and welcome to Film Weekly.
Great to be here.
Yeah, I mean, welcome to Britain. And I kind of say you've come out of the hot spots of Chicago to be here, and you've brought it with you, really, in a way.
It's my fault, I think.
Yeah. Let's start with that, really, because you're here, you know, the riots and Britain is burning around us. Have you seen similarities between the two?
Well, you know, I only know what I've read in the papers and from talking to people here. I haven't visited these communities at all, of course. But it seems like there are some similarities. I mean, what touched this whole thing off seems to be a profound level of tension between the police and people in that community,
yeah.
Tottenham, right? And we certainly see that in Chicago. I mean, the communities that we were in filming, they really don't trust the police.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on decades of their experience. And so, you know, and when there are things that happen, they don't go to the police generally. That's considered a betrayal of the community. So I see that connection. I also see, I think, there seems to be a sense of hopelessness, a sense that what is our future going to be? Do we have a future in some of what I've read and seen here? And you certainly feel that very profoundly in places like Chicago. I mean, these communities are back on their heels in a significant way. There's been huge foreclosures, vacant lots, schools in trouble. I mean, you know, it, in some respects, it's as bad or worse than it's ever been.
What's interesting about your film, The Interrupters, is you say that the people don't go to the police, and The Interrupters as a group have tried to become the intermediaries as well, as when they interrupt the violence, but they also are offering a pathway between, I suppose, the two communities, the entrenched kind of authorities and the entrenched kind of, I don't know if we can call them rebels or whatever community we can call them, though, who are about to commit violence, even because they don't even know any other way of expression. The Interrupters have become a sort of a police force in some kind of way, by default.
Well, if you said that to them, they'd go, oh, no,
right.
We're not police at all. And truth be told, they can't be connected to the police in any formal way.
No, as your film, the later stages of your film show that in operation, they can't be because they're a witness to certain elements that can't, that their trust would be completely betrayed.
It would be completely betrayed. And so, you know, I think what the Interrupters are trying to do, you know, they would say that what the police do is they come in after a crime and that's when their job really begins. And for the Interrupters, their whole goal is to prevent the crime or prevent retaliations and further crimes. And so they're very careful about how they deal with people in the community. You know, they don't ask more than they need to know. They're very careful. It's almost like they're you know, therapists or lawyers. Tell me what I need to know and no more, because they don't want to be put in a position where it could be a problem with the police.
It seems a very interesting situation that you say. You mentioned therapists and lawyers, but the therapists and lawyers are trained, qualified, they've done a lot of work for it or something. Some of the Interrupters obviously are, but some of them aren't. So they're asked to do those jobs of highly qualified, skilled people, and yet they don't have it. But they do have their street smarts. They do have experience that perhaps the lawyers and psychologists wouldn't have of the actual people that they're talking to.
Absolutely. I mean, the Interrupters do go through training as a course of becoming Interrupters. They start as outreach workers in the organization, and then you work your way to becoming Interrupter. But the truth is that their resume, if you will, of their past activities is the best resume you could have for this kind of work. It's probably the only kind of work where that resume really works for you.
Yeah. I mean, Amina, who I think is the complete star of your film, she was on the front page of The Observer only last weekend, but I mean, she's just fantastic. I don't know, this person, you couldn't have invented it. I mean, she sounds absolutely brilliant. If she was played by Angela Bassett several years ago, I wouldn't have said that it could be any better at all. She was just superb. One of the great subjects of all documentaries of all time, I think she is.
Oh my God.
What a person you found there.
Yeah.
I mean, she is all of those things. She's a firebrand, she's a psychologist, she seems to be a sort of whirlwind and a conduit between everything.
That's right. I mean, Amina is immensely skilled at this work. She does nothing by accident. And so she really takes a situation and pulls an arrow from her quiver that fits the situation. Sometimes it means sitting on a park bench quietly and talking to a young woman, Capricia, who you get to know quite a bit through this film. Sometimes it means kicking Capricia's butt, if necessary. Sometimes it means getting in the face of young, you know, gangbangers and really telling them what to do.
And her speech at the funeral
is amazing.
It was an extraordinary speech. You couldn't have written that.
No. She's an incredible force of nature.
Yeah. I need everybody from the ages of 13 to 24 to stand up, man. I'm the second oldest daughter to Jeff Ford, to ones that call Malik chief, and I'm fed up.
That's right.
Because each and every one of you all can be duped right here. My brothers. I know we hurt because we love duped, but we got a responsibility to bring up our community to be vibrant. Whatever it is that's going on, cease the fire, call a truce.
And in this turbulent week for Britain, The Interrupters is out nationwide from Friday, the 12th of August. And that brings us to a close for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the excellent score to Jose Padilla's Elite Squad Enemy Within by the Brazilian guitarist and composer Pedro Bronfman. That's also an excellent movie, by the way. Didn't have time to review that. Because for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.